Welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Perron. Authorities in Victoria, Australia are wearing out the aftermath of a prison riot they described as a major security breach. Heavily armed police regained control of the reprimand centre in the western part of Melbourne. Overnight, an estimated 300 prisoners rioted, some wearing masks and brandishing sticks. They knocked down an internal wall, smashed through windows, and lit fires. It is believed it is a reaction to a smoking ban that will take effect in the state prison this week. In Melbourne, Tim Nightingale reports.
It was a dramatic operation overnight that ended a 15-hour incident. A helicopter hovered overhead with a spotlight as heavily armed police regained control of a remand centre in Melbourne's west. The Victorian Corrections Commissioner, Jan Shuart, is keeping details under wraps.
They did make one demand at one stage of us that wasn't contemplated.
And what was that demand?
Yeah, I'm not going to reveal that.
An estimated 300 prisoners rioted. Plenty have now been taken to other prisons. This morning it was clear a few dozen had held out till the end.
By the time we got to the end of the exercise, there was around 50 prisoners out and about that we had to bring back in under control. But that took a long time. The numbers decreased as the day went on.
The riot and a small fire at another prison have been linked to a ban on smoking in Victoria's prisons that takes effect today. But the Police and Corrections Minister, Wade Noonan, wasn't willing to admit that was the cause.
It's not yet clear whether that was the trigger, but certainly in relation to that issue, significant effort and planning had gone into that area.
Corrections Commissioner Jan Shuard indicated the smoking ban was probably to blame, but she was emphatically defending the change.
We continue with our nicotine replacement therapy, with our quit programs, with our additional recreational activities and all the things that have been put in place to have us ready for a non-smoking prison environment. This is about the long-term health and well-being of our staff in the prison system and the people that come into prison.
Three prison staff suffered minor injuries, although the government says it wasn't due to direct contact with prisoners. Four inmates have been taken to hospital, two with dog bites, and a fifth has a broken jaw. Authorities admit the fallout could have been far worse. Corrections Minister Wade Noonan.
I think it's fair to say that I am deeply relieved that no one was seriously hurt. The events of yesterday are unacceptable. This behaviour will not be tolerated.
All Australian states and territories except Western Australia have either brought in a ban on smoking in prisons or are planning to do so. WA is holding out due to fears of a prisoner backlash. With a similar ban due to take effect in New South Wales next month, the state's Corrective Services Commissioner wants an urgent briefing from Victoria. The Victorian government is promising a thorough inquiry into what caused the riot and its response.
Thousands of asylum seekers who survived the difficult journey from Myanmar are finding themselves trapped in a new cycle of poverty and ignorance in Malaysia. An estimated 25,000 asylum seekers have fled Myanmar this year, looking for a better life in another country. Thousands have been given temporary shelter in Malaysia, but now they face years of limbo. Izzak Tangdar Razak filed this report from Kuala Lumpur.
Every day, this group of asylum seekers scours the streets of Kuala Lumpur on scooters or bicycles for any kind of trash they can fix, recycle or resell. Refugees and asylum seekers in Malaysia have no work rights, so many survive in the unofficial or grey market. For this group, that means collecting anything they can that can be salvaged. They earn about one Australian dollar a day this way.
This is not enough for our family.
Muhammad Hassan is a Rohingya man from Myanmar and came to Malaysia a few months ago by boat. The Rohingya are Muslim and say in Myanmar they're denied access to schools, hospitals, employment, and at times they're violently persecuted by Myanmar's Buddhist majority.
We are very unhealthy and uneducated and very poor people.
Muhammad Hassan says he'd be happy to go back to Myanmar if the persecution ended, but until then his best hope for a future is in another country.
So we all like to go to our country. If not possible, to go to another third country as Australia, America, Canada, New Zealand, etc.
Since the start of this year, it's estimated 25,000 people have fled Myanmar by boat. Many have been given temporary shelter in Malaysia, but that is no solution. The UNHCR says there are more than 150,000 registered asylum seekers and refugees in Malaysia waiting to be resettled in another country. It also says on top of that, there could be an extra 30,000 unregistered asylum seekers in Malaysia. Some of the Rohingya rubbish collectors have been waiting for years.
If we cannot work here, also we are refugees, how can survive here?
To survive while they wait, the families of the Rohingya rubbish collectors also live together. At least three families live in a cramped two-bedroom flat in Kuala Lumpur. There are about half a dozen children in the flat, and most are just a few years old. On top of the lack of work rights, refugees and asylum seekers in Malaysia also have no education rights and cannot go to public school. But some asylum seekers do send their children to unofficial schools, hidden down side alleys and at the back of houses. This school is for Chin children and is run by donations and by volunteers. The Chin are also from Myanmar but are Christian and also say they're persecuted. Mara Whittaker is an Australian living in Malaysia and volunteers at the school.
There are some 40,000 Chin refugees in Malaysia, and of that about 13,000 are school-aged children, and 40% of them presently have no education, no formal education.
There are about 50 children at the school and they range from the age of about 3 to 15. Mara Whittaker says they're desperate to learn so that if they're ever granted asylum in another country, they have the basics to get a proper education and a good job. But the number of teenagers here is small. As the years pass, asylum seeker families need their children to find whatever work they can in the grey market to help the family survive.
I actually have one student who left last year, she was 12, to stay home and look after the baby. So she's no longer having any school education whatsoever, and my heart breaks for her because I feel that there's no hope for her.
Social workers sacked from their jobs at the Australian-run detention centre on Nauru last year are demanding a public apology from the government. They say they were fired for a false intelligence report about their conduct. Last October, Save the Children staff on Nauru were accused of encouraging self-harm, fabrication of allegation of abuse, and orchestrating protests. But the Moss report into the case found no evidence of any of that. Now, for the first time, two social workers have broke their silence. They say the mass dismissal was an attempt to intimidate anyone trying to help asylum seekers. Natasha Boucher and Michelle Gronghedven are among 10 staff ordered to leave Nauru. None of the workers at the center of the storm have spoken publicly until now. Peter Lloyd reports.
The people who live in sweltering Nauru are located 4,280 kilometres from Canberra, far from the government that sent them there. So far, in fact, they don't even need a name. Former detention centre social worker Natasha Blucher says she often clashed with guards about the practice.
Most of the time if you talk to a child, and most of the time if you talk to an adult and you ask them who they are or what their name is, they will give you their boat identification number. What was very common was for people to feel like that they were being treated like animals. So something that people would constantly say is they think we're animals, they're treating us like animals.
The they Natasha Blucher refers to are employees of Wilson Security. Many are former soldiers and police officers. Blucher says they have a law and order mindset that brought them into conflict with other staff over how inmates should be treated.
And I've seen a woman sobbing at the gate and saying, please, please, I just need to go and see my husband. They took him away last night. He's very sick. I don't know where he is. And this officer just standing there with his hand up going, no, go away, go, shoo, go.
Sinister stories have already emerged about the sexual exploitation of inmates by guards. Natasha Blucher describes an atmosphere where local Nauruan staff saw the camp as a showcase for bride shopping.
That they would say things like, hey, baby, come and sit on my knee. That they would, you know, peer into their tent. They were trying to set it up for when they got outside and they could have a relationship. And the women found that very, very threatening and scary.
In all but name, Natasha Blucher saw Nauru as a harsh prison camp.
The power imbalance is absolutely unbelievable. It's out of control. I mean, the officers can dictate when a person can eat, can shower at a certain time. There's an officer there who turns the water on and turns the water off. You can only move through the camp in certain ways.
Michelle Groenveld is another of the sacked Save the Children social workers.
Biggest responsibility was around the safety, everything from accommodation to food to medical to clothing.
And were all those needs being met?
No, not at all. It's very obvious in that environment that the government do not want to give any comfort or make anything comfortable at all for people.
By last September, some of the numbers on Nauru were so desperate they planned to kill themselves. The government has never disclosed their desperate revolt. Natasha Blucher again.
There was a large volume of suicide packs going on between clients in the camp. They were talking about killing themselves all at once. So, you know, across the camp there was different groups of people who had different agreements to all kill themselves at once. I mean, I would have signed more than 10 of these reports on a Sunday of different individuals stating that they and many others had a plan to kill themselves. And it was from, you know, like, for example, there was single adult females, a group of them who had a pact to kill themselves. There was a group of teenage girls. There was a group of fathers. There was a group of mothers. I think it was along the lines of friendship groups and sort of population groups within the camp.
Not long after that, on the 3rd of October 2014, the government made its move on 10 Save the Children caseworkers. In leaked documents, one official described the public sacking of staff as a circuit breaker. Natasha Blucher has come to see the dismissal as an act of intimidation.
The only reason I can think of is what I said before, which is that, for me, that I was just constantly challenging when I felt that people were not being respected or that where somebody's safety was at risk.
Michelle Groenveld has similar views.
I believe we were scapegoated to take the attention away from what was happening in the camp, which is the sexual exploitation of children, abuse, people's human rights not being met, medical negligence. It's a boiling pot of despair. We were constantly reporting inappropriate behaviour of guards towards children.
Natasha Blucher says she never planned on becoming a whistleblower, but she believes Australia's detention camp on Nauru has become the bitter harvest of successive governments, intentionally cruel to force asylum seekers to give up their claims.
People's mental health violently disintegrating. Children becoming institutionalised and becoming very, very mentally unwell or physically unwell. You know, we've seen people's health conditions deteriorate over the time that they were in Nauru. We know that we're causing unbelievable harm to people and yet we continue to do it for a political goal. Even if it works to stop the boats, it's not worth it.
Now, something that's every traveller's nightmare. You arrive somewhere, crowds are surging by, you look down and suddenly all your stuff is gone. Well, this is the story from our China correspondent, Stephen McDonald. He had an irritating yet uplifting experience one night in Shanghai.
I arrive in Shanghai and walk straight into the mad Pudong Airport Friday night bustle. Your bags are barely off the trolley, and some bloke is asking you if you want to ride in his taxi all the way into town. I know his story. Hello, white moron, I will happily charge you three times the price to the city because you don't know how to speak Chinese, you don't know how much it should cost, and you don't know how to find your way to the actual taxi rank or to the 400-kilometre-an-hour maglev train which doesn't quite reach the city but which will blast away my crappy cab at least to the eastern suburbs of China's self-proclaimed financial capital. But I do know. I know what it should cost. I know how to reach the various alternatives to using him, and I certainly know how to tell him in Chinese where to stick it. How did I get into this gnarly mood? The official taxi queue is too long, and I do take the maglev. On arrival, I walk to the taxi rank next to the station, and after confirming he'll take me to where I need to go, get into the first available cab. Backpack and pelican case into the boot and computer bag stuffed full of equipment onto the back seat. I jump into the front. As we pull away, I notice that his suspicious-looking meter is already on 22 yuan. Where are you going? He asks. Are you going to restart that meter? I reply. Where are you going? He asks again. The meter, I say. Are you going to restart that? He seems angry that I speak Chinese and have noticed his meter, again from him, "Where are you going?" I say to him, "Look, if you're going to try and rip me off, I'll get out." "Well, get out then," he says. Now I'm cranky. I grab my bags out of the boot and try to hail another cab. Accustomed as they are to picking up travellers who've come in on the maglev, they all want to charge a flat, exorbitant rate to get to Puxi on the other side of the river. Bloody Shanghai. I head into the subway and buy a ticket, and then check the map to make sure of the best way to go. Heading in to catch the train, bags first go through the scanner. One, two... Hang on, two? Where's my other bag? Somebody from this filthy, thieving city must have grabbed it when I was buying a ticket. Inside the bag, my laptop, professional recording equipment, two microphones, cables, iPad, old iPod with all my music, Kindle, passport containing my Chinese residency permit. Shit! The contrast could not have been greater between where I'd been and where I was then. I'd come from Jianli in Hubei province, where, in horrendous weather conditions, a ferry heading up the Yangtze River from Nanjing to Chongqing had mysteriously turned, taken in huge amounts of water, and sunk in minutes with more than 450 people on board. This little town was thrust onto the world stage in the most painful of fashions. Its people responded with kindness and caring. Anyone who'd come to Jianli because of the ferry disaster couldn't put their hand in their pocket. Rescue workers, journalists, and especially the families of the victims could barely find a thing to pay for. The taxi drivers wouldn't take your money. In the morning, the local noodles with egg and shallots, free. People rang the Jianli radio station and added their names to the list of homes where the families of the missing could stay and be looked after. There were similar acts of kindness in Sichuan during the disastrous 2008 earthquake. The night before we left, townspeople drove to the main square in taxis with yellow ribbons tied to their handles. Those who walked there tied ribbons to their wrists. Then they lit candles and prayed for the hundreds of drowned passengers that they didn't know, and perhaps more importantly, for the families of the dead, knowing what they faced in the coming days, months and years. Fast forward to the Shanghai subway information counter. "Hey buddy, wait your turn." An American in a suit is bellowing at me. What he doesn't realise is that I have already been to this counter before and asked the woman to contact the police. She gave me a number which rang through to a recorded message. Please, could she use her radio to call the police? She would in a moment. I'd run back to the camera bag scanning team. Maybe my bag was there. No, back to the information desk. Had she contacted the police yet? "Buddy, wait in line," he says. I try to explain to my fellow expat that I had already been to this desk and was not, in fact, pushing in, but, "I know you're pissed, man, but that's not the way to treat people," he lectures me. He can't imagine just how I want to treat him at this point. Finally, a transit police officer is contacted and turns up. "Wait here," he tells me, then returns in 10 minutes. He says that he's just checked the security cameras. When I walked up to the machine to buy the ticket, I was only carrying two bags. Brain, tick, 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 tick. The cab. Maybe when I got out and tried to hail another taxi, somebody grabbed it then. Recall, recall, recall. Oh, maybe I stormed out of the vehicle of the cabbie who tried to rip me off and in a fluster grabbed my bags out of the boot and forgot the back seat. Ah, the bag's gone. I'll need a new laptop, new iPad, new equipment, new passport, new residency permit. The new passport number will mean my press card and driver's license will need to be replaced, and on and on and on. Maybe the police had a camera outside the station. Back into the subway, more persuading. Transit cop back, takes me to their office. I tell this story to a group of police. See, bag is maybe stolen and you maybe left it in the taxi because the driver tried to rip you off. I think at this point the police in Australia would be showing me the door. These guys don't seem too worried until I mention that my passport was in the bag. Well, that's a hassle, they say. If there is such a camera outside, it would belong to the Pudong Municipal Police. They call their colleagues there and tell them the story. No, not just any journalist, I hear him say to them. He's a bureau chief. Okay, they're coming. In the meantime, we go out and check the place where I got out of the taxi, around 100 metres from where I got in. An officer says knowingly. It takes about an hour, but the police from the local area arrive at the subway and take me to their station nearby. I tell the whole story again, not much talk from them, just nodding. Then one of them waves to me, giving a follow me type indication. We walk out of the station and into a nearby building. Doors open, and we're in a room with huge floor-to-ceiling screens covering two joining walls. Watching them is a nerdy bunch in plain clothes, straight out of police tech team central casting. Cola cans, a chubbier one, dishevelled hair, laughing, all hands to the mouse. I'll leave you with them, the uniformed officer says. I walk up to one of these screen walls and indicate on increasingly accurate maps exactly where I was. Then, hey presto, there's the street where I got in and out of the cab on camera right now. It was almost worth losing all that stuff just to be there. I say to them that we should focus on where I got out because I want to see if I took my bag from the cab. All they want to do is look at the moment I got in. I have a feeling they don't really get what's happened. To make it more confusing, the geek team is speaking in Shanghainese the whole time, and I can't understand them. I work out roughly what time it must have been when I got in the taxi. They punch in the time, and there's the same location around 3 hours ago, spooling fast before our very eyes. Stephen, in the past, only takes a few steps into the bottom-hand corner of the screen, and one of them calmly announces, "There you are." Zoom in to narrow the field of vision. Now I'm bigger and walking towards the taxis. I talk to the cabbie through the window. I put my bags in the boot. I put another on the back seat. Zoom in again. I get in the front seat. Zoom and zoom again. Suddenly, there it is, in a huge, clear, frozen image that I'm standing in front of, his number plate. "Gotcha, you bastard," I thought. "Would you like to take that number down?" one of the nerds asks me. Yes, I would. Of course they knew what they were doing. Clutching a piece of paper with a number plate scrawled on it, I walk back into the police station. They also knew what the nerd team would find and ask straight away, "Do you have it?" I hand them the piece of paper. They punch the number plate into a computer and turn the screen to show me. There is a photo of a man. "Is this him?" they ask. I hereby love the police state. I'm not 100% sure it's him, but the police ring his phone number listed on their database. It's a home number, and his wife answers. Naughty, naughty, the officers look at each other. He hasn't listed his mobile number with them as he's supposed to. She passes on his mobile number, and an officer makes another call. Again, it's Shanghainese and hard to understand, but I can pick up the gist of it. "Yes, the police. Pull over and listen to me. A bag. Yes, have a look." He tells the police that he knows nothing about the bag. "Bullshit," I reply. I tell them that he knew very well that I forgot to grab my bag off the back seat. Besides, this was hours ago. How could it still be sitting on the back seat without anyone noticing it? I'm so close to getting this bag back, I can't fall at the last hurdle. A policeman looks me in the eye and says firmly and confidently, "Don't worry, I'll get your bag back." I believe him. He calls the driver back and uses the full tilt, this is the police talking, tone of voice. After a stern conversation, he returns to relay the result to me. He's got it. Whoa! Yes! I'm told that he's a long way away and that it'll take some time for him to deliver it to the police station. Initially, he wanted to bring it the next day. No way. The policeman tells the driver that he's sure I would pay whatever it is on the meter for him to drive to the station. If you gave him 500 more, he'd come in a flash, the officer says to me. Tell him I'll pay 200 plus whatever's on the meter, I say to the police. So more than 3 hours after this driver tried to swindle me and I cleverly dodged it, I'm now going to hand him around 300 yuan to return my things. It's more than 3 times what my original rip-off price would have been. It's going to take ages for him to get there, so I head across the road and have some dinner at the local community restaurant. As is often the way in the Chinese summer, the men have their shirts rolled up to expose their round bellies, which they rub every now and then in between slugging back mouthfuls of long-neck beer with Sichuan pepper food. La wai, they cheers me, and we all have a beer together. I return to the police station, and I'm told that the driver is not coming. What? He says his car's broken down. Yeah, sure it is. Instead, you'll get a colleague to bring your bag here. Isn't that interesting that he doesn't want to come to the police station? I wait and wait. And then 5 hours after I'd left my bag in the taxi, it's returned. Check inside to see if everything's there, I'm told. It all is. Everything has been rammed back into the bag in a hurry, upside down, sideways, skew-if. I have a clear mental picture of it all spread out across a bed at some dodgy operator's house in the far west of the city, and my dodgy cabbie haggling with him over a price for the lot. Then he has to go back in there, buy it all back, shove it into the bag, and get it to the police station in anyone else's hands but his. Anyway, who cares now? I've got my stuff back, and I'm so relieved. I pay the new driver the money. I hope he didn't pass it all on to the original cabbie. The main policeman who's been helping looks at me with a smile and says, "The Shanghai cops, not bad, eh?" Yep, the Shanghai cops are not bad. So what have I learned? Yes, the people of Jianli are a good lot. No, Shanghai isn't a city with only money-grabbing fraudsters. Yes, one should be careful of being hoodwinked. No, you shouldn't let anger get the best of you. Yes, I am a bloody idiot. And yes, the Shanghai cops are not bad. This is Stephen McDonald in Shanghai.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen McDonald, for that interesting audio diary of your experience in Shanghai. Anyway, with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. We'll see you again very soon. Bye for now.